Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. Today we're going to look at the season so far in Formula One. So joining me today, I'm Jack Phillips, digital editor, is Mark Hughes, Grand Prix editor, Simon Aaron, features editor, and on debut we've got Rob Ladbrook, who is production editor. So we've got 1 hour until the builders next door interrupt things. So let's get straight in. Good season, bad season, Mark?
Mixed, but it's had some special moments, yeah, and some very unexpected twists and turns. But yeah, as ever, some things clearly could still do with some work to improve the show.
And you guys agree, the most competitive season for quite a while, I'd say.
Certainly in terms of the hybrid era, I think. We've had 12 races now. Red Bull have won three, and then What's the split between, is it 5-4 Mercedes and the others?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is how it's been split, because I think it was James Allison at Merck was pointing out that it's something like 7-5, but it's the wrong way around. The cards that
Mercedes
everybody agreed
to win,
was the fastest, has ended up winning quite often. So yeah, it's only a function of how competitive it is when that can happen. So it's good.
I think the main thing is that we need to hope that, I mean, there's been a trend in recent years to get to the summer break, then you come back from your holes and either Vettel or Hamilton or whoever it might be rushes off and wins most of the remaining races. And so you think you've got a nicely balanced title contest, but the post-summer reality sometimes is that that doesn't happen. Don't you? I mean, do you think that's, are we going to get a one-sided post-summer situation, or do you think it's going to remain reasonably competitive?
I don't think so. I think, in terms of performance, the momentum is with Ferrari. The engine gains they've made at the moment. Mercedes don't understand how they've got them. So that promises, that's got a reasonable degree of promise for a very, because Hamilton's leading by a handy margin, but the faster cars behind, hopefully, that's going to make the second season quite finely poised. Although Hamilton has got a habit of stepping it up a gear after the summer break, but we'll see.
I mean, I think actually in a lot of terms, it's been so far the season that Formula One needed. So after so long of kind of Mercedes strangulation, from a casual spectator point of view, I was actually at a family barbecue recently, and someone came up to speak to me during the Grand Prix, and they said they thought it was funny that they wouldn't let anyone get a couple of races clear this year, and they almost thought it was fixed in a kind of in a kind of put together way. But actually, Lewis has obviously since gone on a little bit of a run since then. But in terms of rejuvenating interest in Formula One, I think it's actually done quite a lot, because we needed a Ferrari to step up and we needed a Red Bull to make some tactical gambles.
I mean, the signs were there last year that Ferrari was, you know, rejuvenated. There were many races last year where Ferrari actually had the faster car, although they tended not to be able to qualify ahead. Then that pretty much defined the Mercedes advantage. But had it not been for that sort of reliability collapse close to the end of last year, they would have been in contention last year. But the feeling was they'd missed that opportunity and it wasn't going to come again, because everybody would see the tricks that they'd used with that car, and it was a very, very innovative car. Everybody would catch up to that and leave them behind, or Mercedes would leave them, but it hasn't worked that way at all. And they've come back actually stronger.
I say, because they've come up with new tricks, haven't they?
They've added
to the previous collection of tricks.
Yeah, they have. They are probably the most creative of all the top teams at the moment, I'd say. Look at the last 2 years of the stuff that they've had. And they're doing what Red Bull used to do pushing very hard against the regulations. They're always being questioned, always being queried, and that's just a function of the creative process, and they are right on it now.
For the first time in years, there's also been unreliability factored in, which has kind of created a bit of a false position on the table, especially for Bottas, I think.
Yeah, Bottas has had a terrible look. I mean, he's could easily be looking at, you know, sitting on three Grand Prix wins, and he hasn't.
He could be ahead of Vettel. If luck had gone his way, he could have been with Vettel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
easily.
He's tended to perform best when on those weekends where the car's been not quite there, and Hamilton's sort of struggled with it, and he's, I mean, the one, I think it was China, where Vettel had led, but he'd undercut ahead in a car that wasn't quite as quick. That was going to be a really, really impressive victory, that. Then the safety car interrupted it, and we ended up with a Red Bull tactical advantage. But, also Baku, he was going to win. So, yeah, he's very more regularly impressive than last year. Last year, he had his peaks, impressive peaks, but this year, he's hit those, you know, much more consistently.
We've had this been the summer break. It was where you normally get the deals that you're expecting to be struck. So you get normally Raikkonen signed. This year, we've had Hamilton and Bottas. And then just this week, Ricciardo, who we'll go into that in a bit more detail after this on Facebook, which you'll be able to see if you go to our Facebook page. But still, the quick mention that now, a bit of a surprise.
Total surprise, yeah. He'd been carrying around a contract for 2 weeks in his briefcase, apparently. And he did very well in convincing everybody that it was just because there were a few details and I's to dot and T's to cross. And obviously, we since found out why he wasn't signing it. He was seriously considering the Renault offer. And he's made the jump. Very brave, but totally unexpected. It's led to the natural question of, does he know something that we don't, i.e. is Adrian Newey going there? And it's a logical question. I don't think he is, but I don't know that he's not either. So let's wait and see. But short of that, I struggle to see how it's going to put him in a better position in the 2 years that he has the contract for than if he just stayed put. But let's see.
I mean, it's there's a bit of a pattern developing, isn't there? Australians kind of surprising Red Bull by announcing they're off somewhere else without actually letting the team know till half an hour beforehand.
Yeah, usually because they've got a little bit of a bee in their bonnet about the team's treatment of the other guy. Seb in the first instance and Max now. So I don't think it's a really deliberate policy. I think Max has just ended up he's like the eye of the storm. Everything just sort of gravitates towards him. And it leaves the other guy sort of a little bit out on a limb. And even though I think materially he's had equality, he's had equal treatment, he just psychologically, I think, just like Mark before him, as related to Seb, he just feels a little bit, you know, the slightly less favoured one.
And it's no small undertaking either, is it? I mean, in my opinion, last year or three, Red Bull has had the strongest overall driver pairing in Ricciardo and Verstappen. And I think next year Renault might have that with Ricciardo and Hülkenberg, arguably.
It'll be interesting to see those two compare.
I mean, I'm looking forward to it in many ways because, I mean, given the strength of Hülkenberg's track record all the way through the junior categories, how he came in, stepped up, you know, from Formula BMW A1 GP, dominated, won GP2 title in his rookie season.
Yeah.
Scoring three times as many points as Pastor Maldonado, who's in about his 58th season. Mm-hmm. For some reason, it's just not quite happened for him in Formula One.
Yeah.
Everyone knows how good Ricciardo is. I'm really looking forward to seeing how those two compare with each other.
I still have question marks about Hulk. Not about his speed. He's devastatingly fast and fantastic in a wet. It just seems a bit of a coincidence that every team he's driven for has had a tire deg problem.
Yes.
Let's see.
Has that been a Pirelli era thing? Because in 2010 on Bridgestones, I don't recall that being a...
Yeah, I think it's a Pirelli era thing. And we're now going with tougher Pirellis, but we might be going back to chocolate Pirellis. So we'll see.
But he was good at Le Mans on endurance tyres without wanting to bring sports cars into the conversation.
He was good on Michelins. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. So Warren Renault, I think the easiest way to do this maybe, because we've had so many questions, to break this into teams and then go through people's questions. Mainly, weirdly, a few from Mercedes, more from Ferrari, but just on Renault. Tony Chan said, if you're a betting man, would you say that mid-2019 Honda's power unit would have outperformed the Renault?
If I had to bet, yes, I would say so. I think Honda of showing more commitment, more financial commitment than Renault, who are trying to do it on a budget, and Honda isn't. So they joined in a year late. It's taken them a long time to catch up. But in those 2 years, if you ask me who do I think would be ahead of between those two, I think it would be Honda, yes.
I also get the impression that Honda has this year had a more cooperative technical partner in Toro Rosso.
Yeah, definitely.
And Toro Rosso has been more willing to
adapt
the car to the engine's requirements.
True.
In a way that McLaren
And then the both parties have been a lot more open with each other. As Toro Rosso were showing them things about their car that McLaren had never shown them about theirs, Honda reciprocated and said, oh, come and look at this. This is a research program we got going. And I think that has gelled. That relationship has gelled much better than the McLaren one, albeit it's a more mature program, so you'd expect it to. But it is going in the right direction.
I think Tony Chan has also said that he feels that Renault were spending money for exposure, exposure at all costs, whereas Honda wants a win at all costs. Do you think that's fair, Rob?
I think it probably is fair. I mean, if you look at, Renault's been there and had success, and Honda's obviously not had success for 30 years, essentially. And you look at the progress they've made, and I also think they've got the bit between their teeth, because we were all probably quite hard on Honda in the McLaren era, and we've since worked out that actually it wasn't all Honda. And I think they're getting a bit of vindication now from this Toro Rosso program. So you look at, Gasly's results in particular have been pretty strong. And looking at the Renault era at the moment, they've also made some progress, but there's been constant delays on ERS and problems like that, where Honda seem to be feeding things more regularly now. And I just think that's an interesting swing, especially with Honda having the upgraded UK engine plant. I mean, Red Bull must know something. I mean, they're not the kind of team that's just going to fall out with Renault and say, right, well, you know, you've upset us, so now we're just going to go and gamble on something else and throw away all of our Formula One history that we've frankly fought hard to get.
A couple of our readers have actually blamed Alonso for the partnership with McLaren and Honda breaking down. Peter Spears says, do you think the influence he appears to have over the running of McLaren has contributed to the mire it now finds itself in? So I guess that knocks on
not,
from the
not a first order. I wouldn't say it was the first order reason. His criticism, his very public criticism over the radio, certainly wouldn't have helped the relationship. But I think it was a fractured relationship long before we started hearing that. Alonso doesn't hold back in his public pronouncements. Probably doesn't help when it's a delicate situation, but it's not the reason the relationship fell apart. The relationship fell apart because the two sides were not cooperating. And I think, in hindsight, McLaren was hiding behind the Honda shortfall, which was absolutely there, but it rather than examining itself for its own weaknesses, it was assuming it didn't have those weaknesses and just saying, well, it's all the engine's obviously a long way short, and therefore that's all the problem, all of it. And it wasn't.
I thought it was quite telling. It was in Baku where Fernando clattered the car on the opening lap, knocked off about 30% of the aerodynamic bits, and then found it better afterwards.
Yeah, well, he also on the way back, lack of tyres. I think he had three damaged tyres, didn't he? It wouldn't actually turn unless he hit the barrier, and he got the barrier to make a turn. He'd had to do that three times, including the one in the pit lane, just to get it into the pit apron, and he got it going again. And it had ripped a great big hole in the in the floor, which allowed it to fly down the straights, which it hadn't done before. And he said afterwards, only half jokingly, he said, "That's quite a good upgrade."
Is James Key the man to turn them around, do you think?
I think problems go deeper than a new technical director. Although, you know, the recruitment of James is a very positive thing. He's a very good guy. But I think, it's recognition of the limitations that is sort of almost in the DNA of the team that have been there for probably 10 years or more. And it's taken this long for it to unfold for us to see clearly just how far behind it's fallen.
So do you think Boulier maybe stepped into a role that...
Yeah, I think Eric was handed a role that really he couldn't win with. He maybe took too long to understand that, and that there were things that he needed to get on top of that he was going to get blamed for if he didn't get on top of them. But as I say, that I think the problems run deeper than just who was running the team.
Yeah. And do you think he's quite a bullish guy? Do you think that maybe worked against him in that he wasn't maybe willing to accept?
Yes. Yeah. Probably. He started to get very defensive as it became obvious that he was going to become the scapegoat. So naturally, he became defensive, but I think his fate was already sealed by then.
Do you think next year is too soon for them to turn around?
Not turn around, not in terms of improving their performance and moving up the grid. No, I think they probably will. But in terms of being potential race winners, it's a long way away.
You both agree with?
I think I do. I mean, we've seen some words from Zac Brown as well recently saying, you know, it's not going to happen in a year. And I mean, even if you get a great mind like James Key in the door, we've seen these kind of examples of silo thinking at McLaren, where the chassis guys only want to care about the chassis, or reportedly the suspension guys only want to care about that, and you get a complete lack of information. And if the guys building the car can't talk to each other and that flow of information isn't there, how can they possibly pass it on to Honda? And then how can Honda come back with it when their technical center is the other side of the world? So there were, all sorts of issues there. I think it needs quite a big rebuild. Looking from the outside, I don't even see it being a particularly attractive proposition for big name drivers at the moment either, because they know they're going to be walking into something that needs substantial work to get it back to where it should be.
I mean, the scale of the decline reminds me in some ways of teams like Tyrrell in the past, who, you know, were a major powerhouse in the early 70s, but gradually over the period of the next 15-20 years kind of drifted towards the back of the grid. I mean, McLaren's decline in some ways has been sharper than that. They've got greater resources, which would give them a fighting chance of working their way back towards the top of the pile. But as Mark says, I mean, I can't see it happening anytime next 3-4 years, can you?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they've got very wealthy shareholders, and if they needed to have a bigger budget, if the shareholders deemed it appropriate, they could have as big a budget as anyone. But I think they're a bit reluctant to put their hands any deeper into their pockets, because they've just been convinced to, you know, surrender $100 million worth of partnership and exchange for something else, and that this would be the solution. And for arguably competitive neutral. So once you've been asked for the money and not delivered, to come back and ask for some more money is probably probably going to fall on deaf ears until they're a bit more confident of the management that's in place.
One last thing on McLaren. Gareth Davies has asked whether Van Dorn is being hurt, his reputation has been hurt by the car.
Yes, it's been very hurted.
Yes. Terrible hurt. I'm a journalist, it's fine.
Yes. His reputation has been damaged because he's been totally outperformed over a season and a half by Alonso. And if you're coming in as the next big thing, which he he did, you would at least expect him to challenge Alonso and beat him every now and again, and that just hasn't happened. It's much more difficult to do that in this era of no testing. You don't get anything like the preparation you used to get. So experience does count for an awful lot more. And because of the difficulties of being in, he has tended to not have been a priority and sort of fallen into the number two status. I think his potential is what we saw beforehand, but whether he can ever access it, I don't know. It's very difficult after you've been psychologically damaged like that to come back. A fresh start, you know, another team maybe, we might begin to see that fantastic potential that we saw in GP2.
Is there a space though? Because if science does come in, then...
Yeah, I mean, there may be space at somewhere like Toro Rosso, but yeah, it wouldn't be surprised if he's not on the grid. So yeah, it's up in the air, that one.
Yeah, to my mind, it's one of the great shames of the current era, is that a young driver like that, who, again, the Hülkenberg thing, I mean, who showed such immense form, but Van Dorn's case particularly, I mean, he made his Renault 3.5 debut and was winning from his first weekend against more experienced teammates. He won on his debut weekend in GP2 as well, and then he comes into this, and all the signs are that he's exceptional, and after a year and a half against, he's still, I mean, I know Ferdi's exceptional, we know that, but he's not really been, he's just not making inroads, or doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, his driving style was particularly Dams GP2, which they have a very specific setup, and demands a very specific driving style, and wasn't the most appropriate
ART.
ART, yeah. To Formula One, but I mean that's the sort of thing you sort out after three or four races of understanding. It's been a season and a half, so that's not an adequate excuse anymore.
I mean, we saw a similar thing with Charles Leclerc, didn't we, when he came in. He said he was overdriving the car, and that's why he was suffering against Ericsson at the start, but he seems to have got on top of it.
Slightly different trait, but yeah, I mean, he was chasing response in the car, so he was chasing, like, quick from turn into apex. He wanted quick response, which you can actually build quite a lot of that into the car with the suspension. And once he started to believe his engineers that you could do that and you didn't have to be all driver input, he got a more stable, progressive car, and he was able to get some confidence from that. And it was just fluke, because we went to Baku, which was round four, and they said, look, it's a street circuit, you're going to hit things with it like this, let's do a tamer, can you just listen to us for this one, let's do a tamer setup. And so he did, and he went with it, and he said, oh, this is great, this is much better. I said, yeah. So then he was flying, and he's not really looked back since.
So before we move to the front of the grid, just the last few words on teams at the back who are maybe on their knees. Teams like Williams and Force India. Is there a future for Force India?
Oh, I'm sure there's a future, yes. We just don't know at this point who the owners are going to be. And there's some matters to be sorted out in terms of the other teams agreeing to, you know, for them to continue to receive the prize money for finishing fourth on the constructors. I'm sure that will be sorted out. Whether it's with the agreement in place with Mercedes for wind tunnel share and aero support, that's a different question. That, as I understand it, was in place before the team went into administration, and it takes the team more towards the Haas model, still not completely the Haas model because it'd still be building the car, but takes it more towards that. And the obviously teams like McLaren, Williams feel very vulnerable to that model, and so they were using the opportunity of the team being in administration to question that and ask for some assurances before they sign off.
And I guess if they lose Stroll to Force India, Williams are going to be even more backs against the wall than...
Yeah, but maybe the Ricciardo thing has changed all that, because it means that Ocon is no longer going to Renault, so maybe there isn't space at Force India, I don't know. Because he's still, unless he buys the team, but as I understand it, he didn't want to buy the team, he wanted to put money into the team, but not for a shareholding, but maybe that's, he sees that, he maybe changes his mind now.
Do you think also that Williams is so far adrift that Mercedes wouldn't put Ocon into Williams?
I don't think they would put Ocon into Williams, no. Because they would want to keep the momentum, the forward momentum of Ocon's career going. Yeah. And on current form, that wouldn't happen.
And on that point, actually, James on Twitter has asked if Williams employed a proper racing driver, his words, how far up the grid would they be? What do you guys think?
Not that much further up. The car's so bad, I don't think... There's a lot of times its grid position wouldn't change if you put Lewis Hamilton in it. You know, the car is so far off. There's certain circuits where its weaknesses aren't punished so badly, like Baku, for example, where a proper driver might have just scraped it into Q3 rather than just missing Q3. But, you know, the difference between Sergei Sorotkin and Fernando Alonso is probably less than a second. So that's not the dominant shortfall when the car's three and a half seconds off the pace. You can forget trying to prioritize drivers. Drivers can be a very galvanizing force and can sort of inject a sort of urgency into a program with their personality, and they can work well with engineers and to find solutions more quickly. But they can't fundamentally change the fact that a terrible car is a terrible car. So that's like number 15 in the list of things to do, is to get a better driver.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very unfair that Sorokin and Stroll have both been targeted for, you know, perceived ineptitude. But, you know, Stroll won the FIA European Formula 3 Championship. Sorokin was a race winner regularly in GP2, finished third in the championship. You know, they're inexperienced, they're very young, but they're not hopeless.
But the models changed somewhat. I mean, forget Stroll, that is a family thing. His father's paying for that. But in something like Sorokin's case, or you see it with Maldonado, they are quick drivers that have attracted personal backing through being quick drivers, and they've then taken that personal backing to various teams to get their careers up and running, which is no different to what Niki Lauda did, or, you know,
Fernando Alonso
did, Ronnie Peterson used to do, even late into his career. That's normal. So to say that's a pay driver is technically accurate, but hugely misleading.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's an unfair, unfair criticism, really, because I think Sorokin has delivered pretty impressively this year, given the limitations of the car. He was fantastic at Monaco, for example, and he was one of the recent ones. Was it Hungary or Germany? It was one of them where he was very impressive. He had the car much further than it should have been when you were watching it out on track.
How much do you think with the Sorokin thing as well? He's almost been tainted by being the guy that beat Robert Kubica to the seat. I know, obviously, Kubica had his limitations. Williams have looked at the data. Presumably, they've also looked at a check at some point. He almost got tarred straight away as the bad guy, didn't he? Because he always did that fairy tale.
He was always going to, because, yeah, I mean, we all love Robert, and we'd all love that fairy tale to come true. And this was real life imposing itself on the fairy tale, because the team needed the money, and the money was there, and he performed better at the test. So, you know, it wasn't ever going to work out. The fairy tale wasn't going to come true on that occasion. There's still hope that it might, but there's still question marks about Robert's ultimate performance. I hope he can prove that it's still there or thereabouts, and that he can pick up a race drive, and that would be fantastic. But yeah, Sorokin always was always onto a loser in public perception by putting the kibosh on what would have been Robert's drive. That was going to be Robert's drive. You'd been promised it.
What SMP is doing is no different to what Red Bull's doing. It's just a smaller version and about
yeah,
one country,
arguably, yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
Would the Ricciardo move, does that make it easier for Kubica to find a seat, or is it shaken up so much that he's now in the cold?
Yeah, it could go either way.
It could go either way because it just it's you're looking at game theory, how trying to predict how something will change as a result of something else changing is sort of like the butterfly effect. There were stories that before the Ricciardo move that if Stroll went to Force India, Lance was keen that Robert came with him because he works well together, he learns a lot from him. And I think he gets on well with Lawrence, so there was possibility there. I think Honda is very interested in Robert because of his experience to help him develop the engine, but you probably come up against a blockage with Helmut Marko there because he's not one of their drivers and he's not young. There was talk about Haas when Grosjean kept crashing, so he's struggling to hang on to that seat. I don't know. It's not impossible, but if I was to bet, it would be against a fairy tale.
Just to pick up on one of those points, it's going to be quite interesting, I think, to see how the Red Bull situation pans out, because I mean Carlos Sainz is obviously on the market, and there is a synergy there. Whether they're keen to grab him back, I don't know. Whether they're going to put Gasly from a Toro Rosso up to the Red Bull, I don't know. Whether they'd offer Sainz to Toro Rosso seat, which I'm pretty sure he wouldn't want, who knows? And what's, you know, where Red Bull once had a pyramid of drivers below Formula One, now, as we saw with Brendan Hartley coming back to the fold this year, Dan Ticktum's doing okay in Formula 3, but I don't think winning their three titles is going to get him enough points for a super licence.
I think he's going to be a couple short.
Yeah, he's going to be a few short. So, what does Toro Rosso do next? Where does Helmut Marko go fishing? I don't know.
That's quite interesting itself, though, isn't it? Because for years, you always knew the next people that were going to come into Formula 1. And actually now, when you look at it, I mean, we had years, I mean, for example, when Jolyon won GP2 Parma, the space just wasn't there for him. He had to take a reserve deal, and that's not really the way it should be. Your GP2 champion should get a chance somewhere else. But with the kind of current, let's call it a little void in the Red Bull scheme, you've currently got Toro Rosso. They're now perhaps going to have to look at drivers that haven't been fully nurtured by Red Bull. And we've got people like Lando Norris, and we've got Jack Aitken, and George Russell. Absolutely. I mean, we're almost getting to a little golden age where that top five or six from Formula 2 are suddenly going to be able to find some space.
Don't forget, Max Verstappen
wasn't
on the
Red Bull driver.
Wasn't on the Red Bull Junior.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Yeah, don't people quite often, I mean, I know that Red Bull often claim him as our young driver, but he was their young driver from Formula 1 onwards. Yes, it had nothing to do with him. Nothing to do with him getting to the cusp of Formula 1.
Was still very young, though.
So he was, yes, he was very young, yeah.
So
yeah.
Young, I had to change the rules.
Yeah. There's a question here, actually, on that topic from Alberto, saying that Spanish media are saying the Verstappens have vetoed signs coming back. It's not something I've seen, but is there any truth in this, do you think?
I don't think they have the power to veto, but it's true that the two camps didn't get on well together at Toro Rosso, and you know, given the team's history, that might be a concern. That might play into whether they go with Carlos or not. But I would think actually the team's big and ugly enough to not be too concerned about that. It's dealt with Weber Vettel, it's dealt with, you know, Daniel and Max this year at Baku. It's inevitable those things happen. If you want to run two super competitive drivers, you're going to get those flashpoints. It's going to happen. And I think they'd rather do that than run an easy number one, number two, because that's the low maintenance way of running it. But I don't think that's what they want to do.
Because get borrow Yamaha's wall, maybe, from MotoGP. There's a last thing on Red Bull from DR. Do you think Max Verstappen has changed his driving approach, or is he still?
No, I think all that changed was he got a little bit over rich early in the season, in that he tried to do the same but more, as he'd always done, and there wasn't any more. You know, there's this and all reason deserted him that moment when he tried to go around the outside of Lewis in China. I think helped a little bit by Lewis. Lewis sort of suckering him into it, but he didn't need to fall for it. You know, he could have done it conventionally three or four corners later. And I think that just told you where his mind was at that time. So I think that was the change. The early season, he's going even deeper than he used to go before, and he's now gone back to where he was, and everything's fine again.
Because one of the remarkable things about him, to my mind, was those early races with Toro Rosso, how you'd see him outbreaking people from, you know, half a country away, and never locking up, never, you know, never, no mistakes. It was always clean. It was clinical.
Yeah.
And I mean, his racecraft was superb. And that's what we didn't see in the first half of this year when he was making the kind of mistakes that other drivers used to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's the same with Daniel as well. He's similarly fantastic overtaker, but, yeah, they made it in a bit of an art form. I guess because they've had maybe helped by the fact that the Red Bull is traditionally been down on straight line speed, so you can't do the traditional stick it under the rear wing of the other car and then flick out and then late brake. They tend to do it from a long way back, but what the little detail of it that means that the wheels don't lock is that they get the car turned before the move even starts and then just make a straight line for the apex. Something you see Mansell used to do it as well, and then you're all offline and too shallow by the time you get to the apex, but it doesn't matter. The other guy, you block the other guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just get the whole speed, the speed all taken right the way down, but the other guy has to bring his speed right the way down as well because he's got nowhere to go, and then you're out and away. So that's what they've done that, you still don't see the others picking up on. You see Jensen do it quite a lot, but you still don't see the others sort of twigging it. Oh, yeah, there is another way of doing this. But the engineers will tell you for each track there's a number, a magic number, you need to be this much faster to overtake. So it's typically anywhere between 1.2 and 2.2 seconds, you know, you need to be that much faster to be able to overtake at all. Ricciardo consistently disproves those numbers, you know. He might be only half a second faster. He can still get past. He'll still do
two or three cars at once sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So, there is. I think it's easy if the engineer says, that's it. We've looked at the evidence. I think it's probably easy for the driver to say, oh, well, that's, then I can't do it. Sometimes the driver has to override the numbers.
Is there a case that because Ricciardo's chasing, that he has to take that risk a bit more than maybe a Vettel would do? He can accept fourth.
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it as well, yeah. And as I say, the fact that you're always down on straight line speed, so you can't do it the conventional way. You have to get creative.
You start to sound like Christian Horner.
Yeah. Well, I'm explaining the same fact. Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's move to the front two now. It's about 20 minutes or so left, which should give us enough time. Some people have asked specifics about how Ferrari's made the gap up. LMP's asked how Ferrari suddenly found 38 horsepower, if that could be a number out of the air. Or
it's very specific.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very specific. Yeah.
But maybe they went for 39 but fell
maybe
short.
Maybe it's a kilowatt conversion or something like that. We don't know. And Mercedes don't know, so I don't know. But it's nowhere near 40 horsepower or 38 horsepower over a lap. There may be peaks where it's like momentarily that much higher. The pattern seen from GPS is that the biggest advantages at the beginning of a lap. This isn't qualifying, this is a qualifying situation. There's the beginning of the lap, and the advantage gradually trickles down to nothing by the end of the lap. So that big number they're talking about might be the momentary flash advantage, but it's nowhere near that over a lap. It's doubt whether it's 10 over a lap. But it is something, and it has been there since certainly Austria. It's coming from somewhere. And it does seem to be fantastically efficient at harvesting. And there's even suggestions that with the twin battery, they found a way of harvesting and deploying at the same time. But quite how that would find you advantages on the tracks that we've been to that aren't limited in that way anyway, I'm not sure. So, yeah, don't know. They've found something. I'm sure it is legal. It's not the same thing, but maybe connected to the twin battery arrangement that Merck was querying early in the season, and which resulted in the FIA putting software and hardware on to measure it to make sure it's legal. It's not that issue. That issue's now been, you know, put in a box and controlled. But it might be related to that in the fact that it might be related to something that the twin battery arrangement allows them to do.
He does ask whether if Mercedes doesn't know what they've done, are they satisfied that it's not illegal?
No, they're not. But that's the obvious position of any competitive entity, isn't it? If somebody's beating you and you can't understand how they're doing it, you obviously question whether it's legal. But I've not. You know, I've got no reason to think that it is illegal. I think it's probably just clever.
There's another number here from Valentin who said 10 to 12 horsepower. So it could be.
Well, like, yeah, that sounds more like an average over the lap rather than a flash reading.
Yeah. He also asks the balance of the pros and cons of Mercedes' low-rate concept, which is obviously, we've seen a little bit of convergence with the technology between Ferrari and mm-hmm. Mercedes, but is Mercedes still got the...
Mercedes still keeps a low rake, and everybody else pretty much has gone the Red Bull route of high rake. It's more aerodynamically efficient in that it costs you less drag for a given amount of downforce. There's an argument that it's better in the wet because a high rake car needs more sealing. It needs a more powerful seal at the edges of the floor because there's actually more to seal. There's more negative pressure there. And that gets that seal is provided by vortices, which are created by all the various flips and things you see at the front of the car and hanging off the front wing. And that they are more disturbed by a groove tire than by a slick tire, and therefore it loses a greater proportion of its downforce than the Merck, which isn't relying as heavily on that sealing effect. But that's only a theory, and nobody really knows because everybody would have to have access to everybody else's data to be able to do the comparison. It's just a working theory that might be true, might not be. But again, a bit of traction with Hamilton's performance in the wet in qualifying in Hungary. But actually, had Ferrari not sent Kimi out into the spray of Grosjean, I'm pretty sure Kimi would have been on a pretty resounding pole there, so I'm not even sure that holds up.
And he also asked if they're going to continue with that into next season. It would be too big a change to...
I think they will. I think if they were going to make the change, they would have made it for this season. You're going to a new aerodynamic philosophy. You're losing all the data that you've built up. You're starting from base camp again. It could take you a year or 2 years to get to the level of somebody else that's been on that program for a long time. I think we'll stay with it because it's not clearly inferior. It has downsides, it has upsides. So I think on balance, the high rake one is probably the most obviously effective way, but they're making the low rake one work. So no, I expect them to stay.
Where do you rate the Mercedes Ferrari battle, I guess, in history? Is this up there with the greats, or is this now a little bit too reliant on other factors? You're a bit deferred by Simon.
Thanks, Simon. That's really nice.
Well, you look like you're about to speak, so I thought you can get on with it.
I always have that.
I'll give him some thinking time.
up there with the greats. I think in terms of pushing the boundaries of what you can actually achieve with technology now, then yes, absolutely. We're kind of into untrodden steps, if you like, with two teams. Obviously, Mercedes has enjoyed the supremacy, but Ferrari's been working massively hard and seems to chip away and get that bit closer. Something's changed at Ferrari. The leadership's different, and you can see that on the track. You can see that in the team's mentality as well. So it's very interesting. I mean, the back and forward is quite intriguing, I find. You see, I mean, Ferrari seems to have the one lap advantage, but the Mercedes have just got the consistency. And then Mercedes also, I believe, have just got that little bit extra in Hamilton. Head-to-head, I would probably say Hamilton probably just edges Seb, but there's not much in it. But they've both... It's almost like they've got a reflection of the teams in different colours. Because you've got Valtteri Bottas, who, at the moment, great driver, but seems to be almost quite content to play a bit of a supporting role to Lewis. And then you've got Kimi, who readily... He makes them say it on the radio, which is quite nice. But when they want to try and use team orders, he will begrudgingly obey them and make his point known afterwards, but he will still do it. So you've got the superstar in each team. You've got cars that are both very evenly matched. And then you've also got your supporting actors at the moment.
Yeah, I mean... I'm enjoying, a lot of the time on Sundays, I'm either at Cadwell Park or Lyddon Hill or wherever I might be, or Prescott. But I normally try and catch up late in the evening with what's been going on. I mean, the one thing, it is an intriguing battle, and as we talk now, it's still, even though Hamilton's got a reasonable cushion, it's still nicely poised. The one thing that we don't see, over the years, I guess we've very rarely seen this, is we don't see that many actual mano-a-mano combat on the track. I mean, Silverstone, there was some good close racing between them, and there have been a few times, but generally it's a romantic notion that you're going to see this. The sort of stuff that I see in historic Formula Ford, and you've got nine cars glued together in a lead battle and they're swapping positions all the time.
Is it as good as Tony Sutton's Skoda versus McHill's Volkswagen
Beetle?
Yeah. Is it as good a battle as that?
I don't know. I mean, there was slightly less strategy involved in that, I feel. Mm. And I don't think the Skoda had MGUK or MGUH, far as I recall.
I don't think they were cheating with the twin battery either.
No, probably not. But, I mean, that's
they're probably cheating somewhere.
I know we romanticise these things, but you go back to the early 60s, and Jim Clark, either the car broke or he won by a fortnight. You know, it wasn't super competitive then either. The cars were very elegant. They were lovely to watch. People get in the paddock. It was, there's a lovely band of brothers travelling around together. Lovely romantic notions about what it was like. But the racing wasn't as competitive. It was nowhere near as competitive then as it is now. I mean, apart from the stragglers, what's the typical spread across the top 10 on the grid this year? Second and a half,
about 1.2, 1.3, something like this, that.
I mean, even going back to the days of the Williams FW14B, I mean, there'd be 3 seconds across the first two, three rows of the grid. I mean, it is fantastically competitive now. Whatever people might think about the physicality of the racing, I mean, the level of competition, I believe, is as high and intense as it's ever been in any era.
Because we're on the back of various periods of domination, aren't we? We've had, you go back to McLaren in the 80s, you've got then you're into the Schumacher era, and then you've got a brief period of unknown until Vettel appears, and then you've got Hamilton, and now we're in the summer break, we have no idea who's going to win the championship. So I think it's just maybe rose-tinted glasses looking back, where we, like Tom said, we romanticise things too much. So who's your money on, though?
Vettel? Just because I think that Ferrari advantage will hold. So therefore should logically be him, but there's always something big red alert saying don't bet against Mercedes, you're betting against Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton. So, but yeah, logically I think Vettel. I would have said the same this time last year though, and I'd have been wrong, so who knows.
Yeah, the same question was asked when we did a similar mid-season podcast last year. And I'm quite pleased to say that I was the only one who said Hamilton, everyone else went for Vettel, because they all said, well, they'll use Kimi as a battering ram, they'll use Kimi as this, or whatever. Last year, I just thought the way Hamilton was driving, not that he's driving any worse this year, I just thought there was something about him last year that I didn't foresee Ferrari's late season unreliability, but I just, there was something that made me think Hamilton was going to do it this year. I have absolutely no idea. Hamilton's driving beautifully. Vettel, for the most part, cast the mistake at Hockenheim aside for the moment. I mean, he's also been driving beautifully. I genuinely find it too hard to call this year.
I mean, do you think we've seen Ferrari leading at this stage and we've seen them chasing at this stage, and they almost seem to, especially in the modern era of Formula One, they seem to have developed this wonderful habit of throwing it away, where Mercedes kind of have that ability to remain stoic all the way to the end. I mean, I'd love to see Ferrari win another world championship because I think they're massively overdue one, especially with a driver like Seb on board. But can they really topple that? Can they really take out Mercedes and Lewis when they're in the groove?
I don't know. I mean, do you think there's an element of pressure at Ferrari because they haven't? Well, Kimi was the last champion in 2007. Sure. Do you think is that
part, of that stoicism is the fact that they've had a machinery advantage, so you know, it's easy to remain calm when you have an underlying performance advantage, which is no longer there. And yeah, they are more seasoned in doing that and in bringing home the bacon. But I think there's always a huge pressure upon Ferrari, not just from the Italian, but from all of Formula One, because it reflects well on Formula One when Ferrari do well. It just does. It becomes more popular. So there's, outside of the competitors, there's always a wish to see Ferrari do well, and that places pressure on them as well. It would be given events, you know, with the passing of Sergio Marchionne, it would be incredibly emotional if they pulled it off. But I just keep coming back to the fact that they do seem to have the fastest car. If Seb can handle the pressure, because it is going to be enormous, with Mercedes and Lewis coming at you, I think he's capable of doing that. And yeah, I think he should just edge it.
With Ferrari being faster at the moment, do you foresee Mercedes almost pushing the envelope that bit more? Because we've already seen the kind of fragility of Mercedes so far. If they have to push it that bit further, can that be a turning point?
Well, it might turn out that way, yeah. We've seen the first ever double mechanical retirement of Merck in Austria. And those things happen when you're being pushed on performance, when you don't have a nice handy cushion to give yourself margins. So, yeah, and I think the fact that the current Ferrari engine advantage is coming from an area that Merck confessed they don't understand is what just might swing it. If they can hold on to that secret for four or five races before somebody works it out, then maybe it'll be enough.
Four or five races when it doesn't rain suddenly and upset the apple. It's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, for a long time, Ferrari didn't have a champion driver between Jody Scheckter in 1979 and Michael Schumacher in 2000. And the wider world didn't seem that bothered. I mean, it was nice having Ferrari around. They're a cuddly bunch of Italians who produced the odd half-decent car.
Fabulous coffee as well.
And fabulous coffee. But the pressure that... And the modern age... With
modern era, yeah.
Yeah, it's just much more intense than it ever was back then. Oh, people just weren't bothered then, were they?
That was a specialist activity then, wasn't it? It's not now.
So if we're going to have a five-time champion, and Valentin Rudikan has asked whether Hamilton or Vettel is in the same bracket as Fangio, I would say yes, because I think they're two of the most underrated, because people are too partisan when it comes to Hamilton and Vettel. They either like him or they don't. And
there's that effect, and there's also the effect of people into the history of the sport always tend to undervalue the present because it's now and therefore it's not as interesting as history. Those were the historic bent. There's that.
But I would say no, but not for that reason. I would say the game was so much more serious when Fangio was doing it than now, because you're playing a much lesser game now because it's so much safer. So when you did what he did at Nürburgring in 57, if you got that wrong, you weren't just going into the gravel trap, or you weren't just going to lose a race. You're probably going to end up in the morgue. So to win five championships in those circumstances, as after you've broken your neck one year actually and had to sit a season out, I don't think you can equate those things, regardless of, and that's not their fault, it's not the modern guys' fault, you know, but I don't think they can ever equal that as an achievement, because I think the game is less.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't dilute the fact they will always be, you know, all-time greats in terms of the sport's, you know, overall history. But I think, I mean, I agree with Mark. I think because of the potential consequences back then, I mean, you were pushing the limit as much as you dared, and sometimes beyond, where, you know, the penalty for which was rather greater than, you know, a couple of tenths lost through a corner or a puncture.
I think if you took Lewis or Fernando, Seb or Max, and were able to wipe their memory and knowledge of current technology clean and create this virtual world where we were back in the 1950s and say this is the safest, best car that current technology can come up with, your job's to go and race these, they would be fantastic at it, and they would be competing head to head with those guys. But that doesn't make their achievements now the same.
So I guess history starts again in the 80s, in theory, when you're looking.
Well, it's a gradual progressive change, wasn't it? I mean, you look at an 80s car now, it looks absolutely lethal. You look at an early 90s car with it exposed, you know, the cockpit, it looks terrifyingly. Yeah, at the time you thought they were, you know.
And a final word for the rest of the grid. Bill and Sydney's asked who has impressed most from the midfield, who's sort of from tier two.
Probably Leclerc, just because it's a rookie season and he's done remarkable things. And that performance of Bakke, it was just sensational. It was a time when he was he's holding off Kimi. He was lapping a couple of tenths slower than the leaders, 2 tenths faster than his teammate, and just looking like it was easy. You know, there was no scrappiness to it. It was easy, and he's not always been as impressive as that since, but he's been good. I think, yeah, if you had to pick a standout performer from the midfield, it'd be him.
Is that unanimous?
Well, I'd certainly agree on the drive, but I also think it's worth, you know, giving Sauber a slap on the back, because I know they've got more resources than they've had in recent years, mm-hmm. but they've done with them.
Yeah,
I mean, they've made very good use of them, yep. And they've raised the game from being consistently 18th, 19th, 20th to now being both cars getting into Q2, sometimes into Q3 with Leclerc. You know, I think the whole team has, as I say, yes, they've got more cash, more resources, but they've used them well.
I think Gasly and Ocon have done a great job as well this year, but in terms of where you would have placed your money at the start of the year, I don't think anyone would have said Leclerc would have been quite as impressive as he has been so far, given his machinery.
And so much for the shoe-in for the Ferrari seat, presumably.
Well, he was going to be, I think. I think, as far as I understand, that was happening. But the passing of Marchionne may have changed that. So there were a lot of structural changes that have been put on hold, as I understand. And that may be one of them.
And also, just like to pick up on what Rob just said, I think Gasly's peaks haven't been as consistent as Leclerc's, but the peaks he has had, I think, have been exceptional. Certainly, Bahrain was fourth, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, he has put in some very, very good drives.
Had a fair dose of bad luck as well, where he's been taken out quite early.
Yeah, he has had. Yeah, maybe Romain Grosjean usually, but yeah, he has had a fair dose of bad luck.
Okay, I think we are about to be interrupted by the builders, so I think we better wrap this up now. Thanks all for your time this afternoon.
Pleasure.
Fascinating season still to come, I think, on and off track, and probably until about March next year. So we'll be back soon with the next podcast. Do make sure you subscribe, and we will see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.